On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
How was the conversation? Do we show, do we visualize O'Neill's death?
And one of the first cuts of the film, you know, ended with Bill O'Neill committed suicide. That's it. And then it was, you know, credits. And people were just like, it wasn't even just get murdered. It was just Bill O'Neill committed suicide. Then the music came on and then that was it. And people were like, this is the most depressing film I've ever seen. When we were putting together the outline, yeah, we definitely thought we were going to show his death. But I think, you know, through the script and then finally getting to shooting it, it just would have
been. It would have been very expensive.
Very expensive. And I think also gruesome. And I don't know. I mean, it's one of those scenes where it's like, I like how we ended it. I think the editors and I think Shaka did a great job in just like making sure we ended on Hampton, mm-hmm. and giving his speech and just a bit more hopeful. I think it's right to leave with Hampton.
Judas and the Black Messiah is a hot new film on HBO Max about the life of Chicago Black Panther Fred Hampton and the FBI informant who snitched on him and led to him being murdered by Chicago police. It stars Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield. It is compelling, it is powerful, it is gripping. And the original story was by the Lucas brothers, who've been on this show before. I texted them, I said, let's do it again. We want to come and just talk about this film. They said, let's do it. So here we are, talking about Judas and the Black Messiah with the guys who originally came up with this idea of talking about Fred Hampton and this FBI snitch who brought him down. You can get half of this conversation here for the full thing, which is fully fascinating and deep. We go into the ending that I think they should have had, and they say they talked about that ending, an alternate ending. Go to patreon.com/Torre Show for the whole thing. But let's get into it. It's the Lucas brothers talking about Judas and the Black Messiah on Torre Show. The film is fantastic. It's deep and gripping and very interesting. I watched it twice. Lots of thoughts about it. Explain to me how this journey toward this film even began, because this was originally your idea, right?
Yeah. So we got into comedy around 2010, and we had always been fascinated by the Hampton story and just like, you know, the tragedy of it all and just how, you know, how young he was as a organizer and as a leader and just how like insidious it was that the state, the FBI and the Chicago Police Department and the city apparatus in Chicago, Mayor Daley, Hammerhand, just how they conspired to assassinate him. So it was just one of those things, one of those stories that when you learn about it, you can't help but not think about it all the time. And I think it was right around 2012. I think Trayvon Martin had just been murdered and it sparked all this unrest. And we just started thinking like, how can we use our platform to tell a story that speaks to the times, but doesn't necessarily speak to the time. It speaks about an incident that happened, you know, well into the 60s. So Hampton came back to us and his story came back to us. And we were like, we need to figure out a way to turn this story into a film. So it was around 2012. We started doing more research about Hampton. We read this book called The Assassination of Fred Hampton by Jeffrey Haas, who was a lawyer of Hampton in the '60s. And then we read Black Against Empire. We read Revolutionary Suicide. We started watching a bunch of his speeches on YouTube. And we also stumbled upon this transcript of William O'Neill when he gave his interview with the Eyes on a Prize. We had never seen the documentary. We had never seen video footage of it. We just read the transcript a bunch of times. And as we kept reading it and reading it and reading it, we were like, wait a second, this might be the framework for a film, because to us, you know, it, I don't know, Kenny can probably explain more about it, but to us, when we were reading it, we were like, this feels like a crime thriller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it just sort of, the way he laid out the story, it just sort of read in a, like a sort of classic three act framework. And so we were just like, okay, this could be a good way to organize our story, knowing full well with the intentionality that this is really a narrative about COINTELPRO, about Fred Hampton, and about how the state worked to assassinate a citizen exercising his constitutional rights. So we had all that sort of baked into what we wanted to do, but we had this narrative framework that we thought could work cinematically.
Yeah, and it also felt very biblical too. You know, you have this guy who, you know, gets close to this very, you know, messianic figure. I wouldn't say he didn't see himself as Jesus, of course, but you know, when you read about him, you're like, oh man, this guy had the ability to unite, and he had strong oratory skills, and he had the ability to do things that a lot of leaders can't. And then he betrays them, then he commits suicide. So again, the framework for a story, what it just felt right for cinema.
Well, let's take a step back. So go a little deeper into why Fred Hampton. I remember hearing the story of Fred Hampton as a kid and being very moved by it. The whole story of the Panthers is deeply moving and cinematic. You know, Fred Hampton is a great charismatic character. I wonder why him and not the Oakland Panthers, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who also had similar adventures, for lack of a better word, also had FBI informants, you know, getting in with them. You could have done a similar thing around the Oakland group. So why were you, why Hampton?
I don't know. I think it was a number of things. I think there were some problematic issues with Huey P. Newton and his relationship with women and his relationship with power and his relationship with violence. And so, you know, as a person whom, and again, Huey P. Newton, I don't disrespect him. I understand his importance. I understand his contributions to the struggle. I understand, you know, his commitments, but I feel like as a character for cinema, if we're trying to, if we're having a renegotiation with our relationship and how we're portraying a Black Panthers and who we're going to make our sort of hero, I think we have to really give thought to which character we want to get behind. And I feel like Fred Hampton is just a pure person, just a nicer person, a less cult of a personality type person. And I just felt like it just worked more in the cinematic, but also philosophically speaking, I feel like I probably had more in common with Fred when I was younger, not now. I'm sure not even close to Fred Hampton, but when I was younger, I felt like I probably had more in common with Hampton than I did with Huey. And my relationship with Chicago, I just have a different relationship with Chicago than I do with Oakland. I've spent more time in Chicago than I have in Oakland. And I love Oakland. I love the Bay Area, but I have a different sort of relationship with Chicago.
Is there a story about Fred, or just sort of a way of further understanding him that didn't make it into the film, but still sort of lives in your heart of like, well, if we could have done another hour, we would have gotten into this also.
Yeah.
When, you know, when Shaka and Will first presented us the script, I mean, it was much more robust. It was like, they had like elements of like, you know, how the Panthers went about getting money to finance the hospital and finance the free breakfast program. It went into the particulars of that, which I think could be a very fascinating story in and of itself. Just like, you never really think about it, but it's like, yeah, the free breakfast program costs money.
How did they get money for the free breakfast program?
I mean, it really just like going out to businesses and seeking donations. Mm-hmm. So they would go to like various organizations that presented themselves as committed to the Black cause. And they would essentially just try to convince them to give a donation.
And also Hampton would speak at college campuses.
Right.
And they get money that way to fund their various programs.
Right, right. So his speaking engagements were mostly utilized to raise money.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. So like that was baked into the script. You know, they really went into detail about how they received. That was like his own plot line, actually, receiving money to build the hospital at the end. But wow. You know, because of time, we had to cut that out.
So you guys wrote your story about right. Fred Hampton and Bill O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And then you linked with Shaka, the director.
Right. Right. So, you know, around 2013, we had put together a story treatment. We put together a pitch deck. And, you know, we had it all mapped out for the most part. And we went around town. We went to various production companies, studios. And we just started, you know, we were pitching our story and we got rejections across the board. So we tabled it for about a year, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, we were working with Bernie for a bit. We did our cartoon.
Bernie Sanders.
You know, we were 22. Bernie Sanders. So we were just like, we kind of
Bernie Mac or Bernie, no, Bernie Sanders.
No, we did some volunteer work with Bernie Mac. And
Senator Bernie Mac. Yeah.
But yeah, so we just like kind of like went away from it because we were failing so much and we were just like, we need to rethink our approach to this because obviously we're not able to convince these executives to give us money to make this. So we need to rethink our strategy. And we were like, I think we need to, I just looked at an email from maybe 2015. I was like, I think we need to link with a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. To take us to the next level. And we were just fortunate by the graces of God to work with Shaka on this FX pilot. Mm-hmm. And he was a comedy pilot for Killer Mike. And, you know, we were on set with him for a full day, pretty much. It was a full shoot, 8 hours, maybe even 10 hours. And we got to really know him, just see like his style and his approach to directing and he was just super laid back and we just took a liking to him. And then we went back and watched all of his stuff and then we were like, oh man, this guy's immensely talented. And we think that if we pitch him our idea, he'll be able to not only translate it to executives, but turn it into a cinematic gold. So, you know, before, but we didn't reach out to him immediately, but we just started like in the back of our heads thinking like he could be the person that takes it to the next level.
Right.
Why are you not the screenplay writers?
Oh, because we wrote the story, but they went off and wrote the screenplay. Right. We didn't write the screenplay.
So Will Burson, the other screenwriter on the screenplay, he had already written a film about Fred Hampton, and it was brilliant. It was a bit more robust than what we were coming for. It was pretty much like how he explains it. It was like Michael Mann's Heat, where you know you had Hoover and Fred Hampton sort of basically engaging in this dialogue with one another while not engaging in a dialogue with one another. And it was really brilliant. We all thought it was great. So that's why, you know, we were like, we need to bring him on board because, you know, he wrote a brilliant script about Fred Hampton. We think we could use some of his scenes and some of his work in his screenplay, use our story, synthesize the two. And then now you have a screen. Now you have a screenplay that you can present to studios and execs.
I've seen a lot of you guys' work, and this is not funny. And I'm trying to see where are the Lucas Brothers fingerprints on this. And obviously, you know, we've talked about your life before in the show. You guys are much more than just comedians. You guys were law students. You guys are philosophers. So you're way more than just stand-up. But like, so I'm just trying to understand how does this fit into the Lucas-ness?
Yeah.
That's a great question.
I mean, I think it fits in sort of perfectly because, you know, our thing is always to come from a different angle on whatever genre, like whatever genre we're working in. We want to come from a different perspective. We want to do something that makes it new or at least bold and fresh. And I think with the Hampton thing, our biggest contribution is we said, let's go through the perspective of William O'Neill. Let's make this a story about the snitch. No one was thinking that. No one would even think that that's a reasonable thing to do, because it would upset a lot of people. But I think in our minds, we're like, no, this will make this a classic film.
Yeah, we're even seeing, through the internet and from reviews, like the biggest controversy so far is the fact that it comes from the perspective of the snitch.
Yes, it does bother me to some extent that the informant is a bigger character than this amazing person.
But he's not a bigger character. He's not a bigger character. Hampton drives the story. Hampton is ubiquitous from the very first frame to the very ending of it. Like Hampton's he's so mythological that you can't help but feel his presence in every scene. Yes, I think how we enter the story is through William O'Neill, but I, in terms of the more important character, in terms of just like importance to history, obviously is Hampton. But I think in terms of telling a story in a film, you have to make choices, right? Do you want to do the cradle to the grave traditional by the numbers biopic that we've seen before, that we're tired of? Or do you want to make something that's a bit more genre bending? And I think that our goal was to make Hampton's story a bit more of a genre bending biopic as opposed to a traditional one.
I think what the things that lands for me when I get to the end of the piece, and I'm assuming the audience has seen the film, is Bill O'Neill enough of a villain and a Judas, right? Because this is what the piece is, right? We have the Black Messiah and the Judas, right? Yeah. And his place as a heroic figure is Clint. He's great politically. He's great romantically. Like, right. I mean, everybody's going to love the hell, right? He just saves cats in every scene. We just love the hell out of out of Chairman Fred.
Right.
But I'm like, is Bill enough of a villain? Is he that? Is he really, like, because the infiltrators would lie, would cheat, would steal, would make them look worse than they were. Right. And he wasn't really doing that. So let's talk about that. Like, is he enough of a villain?
I would say yes. I mean, look, he pretended to. Well, he organized the shootout, but he basically facilitated the shootout first by giving the information about George Sams, and then by fucking pretending to be the sniper. All that shit was done by him. He wanted to do the C4 action. I think that he was.
And he also poisoned Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton. Which eventually led to his assassination. Like, I would say, he's absolutely the villain, but he's also an agent of the state. The state is the real villain, right? The FBI, the FBI, Mayor Daley, Hanrahan, Hoover. They're the real villains. And Bill O'Neill is an agent for them. He's working for them. He's their proxy essentially. And I would say unequivocally that makes him the villain, or at least one of the villains in a larger story.
He's certainly the villain. I wanted to see more just dirt dumped on top of him. And when you get to the end and he's like, well, I had a point of view. I joined the struggle. Right. I was like, wait, nigga, you think you were in the struggle?
He does.
He believed it. But he was conflicted. I think that's the beauty of, that's the beauty and the tragedy of the story is that, like, you hear this guy, you see him, and you're like, wait a second, does he really believe that he was a part of the struggle? Or is he lying to save face? And then internally, he really just wants to kill himself. So it's like, I think that's part of the power in going from the perspective of Bill O'Neill is that he's so duplicitous and he lies to himself. And then he ultimately kills himself. And I think that you juxtapose that with someone like Fred Hampton, who was so self-assured, so committed to his principles, so committed to the I think you have a more powerful story. You're actually examining the souls of people. You're not just looking at, you know, the Hampton side of it, but you're looking at the Bill O'Neill side of it, because we've all met people who are more like Bill O'Neill than like Fred Hampton, I'm sure.
Sure.
And I think this is, you want to examine that.
And he does it for so little. It's not right. Like, like even in Queen and Slim, the brother cakes up for selling them right. out. He right. just, right. like, he gets $200,000 over time, mm-hmm. but like right. when they give him the a couple of bucks at the end and the keys to a gas station, I was like, damn, nigga, you sold them out for peanuts.
Yeah. Peanuts. Yeah, peanuts.
But that, but that elevates the story a bit, because it's like yes. the tragedy, because it's like Hampton died for that. Like yes. this great figure died for that. Like, that's like, it just sickens you. You can't help but feel sick to your stomach.
Michelle Obama is one of the most inspiring, intelligent, graceful, unapologetically Black people that I could think of. Just her existing makes me happy, makes me feel inspired, makes me want to be a little bit more like her every day, because she seems to be just this extraordinary person. So if there's any sort of podcast about her, I want to listen to that. Life Kit from NPR has a whole episode on Michelle Obama. It's part of their whole Black Stories, Black Truths collection, where you'll hear stories of Black joy, Black resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account of what it means to be Black today from a unique Black perspective. There's a Code Switch episode about Dr. King, and I love Code Switch. There's It's Been a Minute about Eric Andre, who I love. We are not the same person, even though a lot of people think we look alike, even though he lives in my neighborhood now. But stop telling him he looks like me. Stop telling me I look like him. There's a Pop Culture Happy Hour about the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I loved that show. That show meant so much to me. This is what Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR is all about. Stories about Black America and Black culture. Whole Pop Culture Happy Hour on Abbott Elementary, which is another amazing modern Black show. From Megan Thee Stallion to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air to the women behind the Montgomery bus boycott to the Color Purple, the stories of Black Stories, Black Truths will take you inside the Black community and Black culture. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham. A keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colin McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever
you listen.
Make It Plain covers politics and social justice. From organizers to legislators, it's the conversation you need to get woke.
What else do you know about Bill O'Neill that maybe isn't on the page? Because he's not, he has no, like Hampton has a life, has a, you know, had other people in his family who he goes to, you know, he's growing a family. So we get to know him as a person. Bill O'Neill is just a worker. He never, right? He never goes home, right? He, as far as the film shows, he doesn't have a mom or a girlfriend or whatever. So, like, who is he as a person in this society?
Well, I mean, I think when he was doing his undercover work, he wasn't really involved with many people. I know when he got outside of it, he did get married. He had kids, and they moved to California. He had an uncle. He moved to California briefly, and then he migrated back to Chicago. I think he probably escaped from Chicago because he had, like, probably death threats and stuff like that. So he probably escaped to Cali. But then he came back to Chicago in the mid to late 80s, and he lived with his wife and kids.
But I think in a film, he sort of represents the audience, right? You're sort of like... You come into the film and you have a conflicted viewpoint about the Panthers, you know, based on how Hollywood has treated them over the years, and not just Hollywood, but, you know, the media in general. You know, they painted the Panthers as this terrorist organization that was very militant, and they had guns and they shot up things, and that was about it. But you don't really see a full picture of them, and I think by going through. Coming through the perspective of Will, and, you know, coming into seeing that the Panthers be a more robust organization, you hope that the audience starts to, you know, change in terms of their position on the Panthers. But obviously, in the film, it doesn't have an impact on Bill O'Neill. But you hope that the audience has more of an impact on the audience, at least.
I mean, I wondered if he felt torn. Because he was in the group, and he does start to see, like, wow, they are doing, like, really good things. They are, you know, I'm down for this. He's definitely helping the cause at some level. He's hurting them even more, but he's definitely doing the work and helping them.
Did we talk about this? I don't know if we talked about this before, but this, you know, Ernest Withers, the photographer for the Civil Rights. You ever see that I Have a Dream? I Have a Dream picture, King waving back. Very iconic photo, right?
Yeah.
So Ernest Withers took that photo. He's pretty much known as the father of the civil rights photography. Just I Am a Man. All of that photography, amazing work, captured the movement. I think it's going to stand the test of time, even after we're dead. You're going to see those photos. Turns out he was an informant for the FBI. Right.
What?
So he was an informant for the FBI. So this goes to your thing. He did work for the movement. I think he did marvelous work for the movement. I'm talking like pristine photography.
Yeah.
He's an informant. How the hell do you fucking balance that? How do you balance that? Like, how do you balance those two contradictory
positions? Cognitive dissonance must have been crazy of like, right. I actually like these people.
Right.
And I believe what they're doing. And I'm still.
Right.
But it's, right. I mean, it's a very American story, you know. You know, the American ethos for the most part is rugged individualism. Pull yourself up from your bootstrap. It's very like self-interested, the individual.
Self-preservation.
And I think Bill O'Neill is a very American character, you know.
One thing with self-preservation, I have Panthers in my family. I've read a lot about them. You know, it's one of my favorite parts of that, the resistance. They were extraordinarily on guard for infiltration. They knew the pigs are constantly trying to infiltrate us. So just even the whisper that somebody might have been with the police was enough to get you pushed in the corner or completely excommunicated. And when they meet with the Crowns, and the Crowns make him think like he's a cop, and they're like, And his response is kind of like, Yeah, I mean, like, he's kind of telling the truth, but it doesn't sound like the truth. It sounds like a lie. And I was like, they would have been like, nigga, fuck you. Get the fuck out of here. Like, we don't trust you anymore. And, like, he skirts out of, like, if he came with, like, bam, here's my story, they'd be like, okay, but his story is janky. And I'm like, the Panthers, who I know in my life and in history, would have been like, nigga, you got to get to stepping, man. We can't trust you anymore.
Right. I mean, based on some of the, you know, eyewitness conversations about, you know, Bill O'Neill, I think that a lot of them were skeptical of Bill O'Neill. I don't think that they were convinced he was, and I don't think that they were so, like, convinced that he was a committed Panther that they weren't a little wary of him. I think that some of his actions were a bit outrageous. Like, he built electric chair to electrocute potential snitches. I mean, Fred tore it down and said, there's no way they can do that. But I think that he had done some very extreme things for them to be like, you know, be wary of this guy. What I'm guessing is they didn't think he was that deep with the FBI. I mean, no one really,
because he was committing crimes. You know what I mean? Like, there were moments when he committed crimes, and I guess in their mind, it's like, if he's committing crimes, then there's no way he's a police officer, because they just don't do that. So I think a lot of it was he's going so far beyond what you're supposed to be doing that it sort of made them think that he wasn't an informant.
I think people just thought he was crazy, but I don't think they thought he was. I mean, I don't think they trusted him, but I don't think they thought he was like an informant. I think they probably just thought he was insane.
So I want to come back to this, but who is the Lil Rel character? who is he?
Some people are calling him the FBI pimp.
So just informants are everywhere.
Yeah. But that, I mean, I think that, you know, when people look back and study the COINTELPRO and what they called the FBI called it the ghetto informant program, but there were 7,000 snitches, 7,000, you know, folks throughout the country, 7,000 plus throughout the country. And you just never knew. You never knew who was an informant. I mean, they really played us against one another. Mm-hmm. I think it's captured perfectly in the script. I mean, I think they did a great job in capturing that in the script, and, you know, Shaka did a great job capturing it in the movie.
I mean, that's a moment where you're like, what is happening here? Right. What is going on? Oh my God!
But I think it's like, you know, the George Sam's part of it, which is a true story. It's like, I think it's like, you want to play on that paranoia, like who's an informant, who might not be an informant, where are they? Like the George Sam shit, when we found out about that, it blew our minds. It was like, I can't believe they have another informant who killed a person that they said was an informant. It's like the FBI was really on some psychological warfare shit.
And it was used him to then be able to infiltrate everyone. Now, that moment when Lakeith's Bill hears of what they did to another informant, you really see on his face and in his body how he's torn how he's lying to them about, like, yeah, I would have done such and such. I would have killed that nigga. We should kill these stitches. And, like, you see, like, oh, he's shook, but he's praying. Like, as an actor, like, that's one of his great moments in the film.
Agreed.
Where he really exudes two feelings at once.
And I believe that was improv. That wasn't in the script. I think how he went off and just sort of, you see the fear, you feel it. And it's just like, he's such a subtle actor, man.
Yes. We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door, thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon, a mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
I think one of the other great moments in the script, I mean, there's a lot of great moments in the script, but when Hoover is like, so what are you going to do when your daughter brings home a Negro?
Right.
And like, you kind of get at like the heart of what a lot of this racial paranoia is about. Right. For people like them and for a lot of white people, like we don't want parody. We don't want them in our family. We don't want them with our daughters. We don't want them taking our jobs. We don't want them to our way of life, i.e. white supremacy, is at stake. Right. Mm-hmm. And Fred Hampton is the tip of the spear. And we have to cut this off. And like, I thought that was a really, really amazing, important conversation.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, when Burson wrote his script, it was a lot of Hoover. And the way he characterized Hoover is a way I hadn't seen in a long time. Just like, you know, even you've seen some portrayals of him as being kind of icky, but not like to the point where he's just like so bit of a monster, you know, bit of a just like a cartoon monster who's racially driven. And seeing that play out and seeing it in the movie and reading it in the script for the first time, it was just like, yeah, they really.
I think we really wanted to go for making the FBI seem like they were gangsters. Like that was the crime element that we wanted to invert. Like usually when you watch a crime drama, the police officers are straight and narrow and they're good guys and the gang members are the bad guys. But in this shit, it's like we flipped it. We made the cops the gangsters. Like literally the final set piece, they bang into the house with a fucking Tommy gun. On some sugar, like, and it takes place in Chicago, which I think is beautiful because of their history of organized crime.
Right.
Back to fucking Al Capone.
And you see Roy Mitchell, he has a cigar in his mouth and he's just a straight gangster.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when it's totally gangster, when we get the close up on the sister and they are commenting that Fred Hampton is still alive and they shoot him.
And that's true.
Now he's good and dead.
And that's and those are actual words.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, I've read the story. I mean, like, it freaking is so gangster, right? I mean, like, menace to society. Like, is he dead? Shoot him again.
Right.
And I couldn't imagine
two shots.
How she's feeling, carrying his baby, and she listens to him being murdered. Like, he's still alive. Now he's not, like,
God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's America. I mean, it's the American government. They're so gangster and they project, you know, they project all of their
neuroses and
neuroses on us. And they're afraid of us. But I'm like, you guys are the biggest gangsters. You guys can literally walk into a person's home and just kill him dead in front of their pregnant girlfriend and then just go on with your day. Like, that's some gangster shit.
And pay $1.5 million years and years later.
After all that fighting, after all the courtroom battles, like that $1.5 million that probably went to.
Think about this. They pay William O'Neill a quarter of $1 million to do what he did. Who knows how much money they spent on surveillance of Fred Hampton, bugging him and keeping agents on him and spying on him and all. So I'm guessing the operation must have cost millions of dollars. So they spent $1 million to kill him, and then they spent another $1.7 million to pay the family for killing him. So in total, they spent almost $3 million to spy on a person and then pay the family out. They spent $3 million for that.
Probably spent more money on the spying.
And now multiply that across the country, like.
Yeah.
They probably spent maybe $50 to $100 million spying and killing black people.
I mean, that's they were crazy. Definitely spying on Malcolm just the same. They were spying on Martin. King just the same. They're spying on Huey and Carmichael. Eldridge and them just the Bobby Seal just the same.
Yep. Yep.
It was a budget. Like, they had a budget in the
you know what?
Agriculture,
you know what?
And spy
one thing
on
I wanted Bill O'Neill to kill himself on screen and for not to be a card, you know? And I like, that would have perhaps made me feel more like, okay, the traitor got what he deserved by his own hand. His guilt is so, like, watch Eyes on the Prize, turn that shit off, go in the room and freaking shoot yourself in the head.
Yeah, I mean, that was a conversation. Do we visualize O'Neill's death? I think there were a lot of things that probably would have been tough to do. You have to introduce another character with the uncle. You gotta film a fucking guy getting hit by a car. You know, like, that's expensive. You gotta get the highway. You gotta, like, it's just a much more expensive scene.
Wait, what are you saying? How did he kill himself?
He ran into the highway.
He ran into to the expressway and killed himself. Like, he jumped in front of a car while a bunch of cars were driving by. He just ran into one.
Yeah.
So you thought about, do we show this on screen?
I think when we were putting together the outline, yeah, we definitely thought we were going to show his death. But I think, you know, through the script and then finally getting to shooting it, it would have been very expensive. Very expensive, and I think also gruesome. And I don't know. I mean, it's one of those scenes where it's like I like how we ended it. I think the editors and I think Shaka did a great job in just like making sure we ended on Hampton and giving his speech and just a bit more hopeful.
Well, I think ending it on actual footage of Hampton is, of course, the right note,
right.
And it takes us upward. I long for the other ending of Get Out. Like, I want the dark, you know, blackness is hard. Like, right, you know, Will O'Neill kills him. So he jumps in front of a truck.
Yeah, but you know, in one of the first cuts of the film, ended with Bill O'Neill committed suicide. That's it. And then it was, you know, credits. And people were just like, it wasn't even just him get murdered. It was just Bill O'Neill committed suicide. Then the music came on and then that was it. And people were like, this is the most depressing film I've ever seen. And so, like, you know, it was a lot of back and forth between the studio and just making sure, you know, I think it's right to leave what happened.
For more from me and the Lucas Brothers talking about Judas and the Black Messiah, getting into more of the nuances of this film, go to patreon.com/Toure Show. Thanks so much to the Lucas Brothers for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle Brenda Cox, Kathy F., Dr. Keena Murphy, and Earl Dorsey. Toure Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship
to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show and on Patreon at patreon.com/Torre Show. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean, and we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we'll be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.